Welcome to Radio Gorgeous and Gorgeous Lives with Françoise Malby-Anthony and Katja Willemsen, An Elephant in My Kitchen. And welcoming today an incredible and very, very special woman to Radio Gorgeous, Françoise Malby-Anthony, who has written An Elephant in My Kitchen with the help of Katja Willemsen, who is also here. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome, Donna. Very happy to be here with you today.
Excellent. And Katja?
Thank you. Very lovely to be here.
Excellent. An Elephant in My Kitchen is a memoir. And tell us, what is a memoir about?
The book is about the love of animals, the love of adventure, and the love of Africa. So if you like all this, you will love the book. And if you don't, after reading the book, you will love adventure, animal, and Africa.
Yes, yeah, so you met your late husband, Lawrence Anthony, here in London.
That's right.
You were a fabulous, high-flying, bitchy Parisian businesswoman, if I can say so. I was in New York. I was the same version, but in New York. And it was suggested that you share your cab with this gentleman.
That's right.
Which you refused.
That's right. Yeah, I was first in the queue. He was last in the queue, and I was in a bad mood. So when the porter asked me to share my taxi with him, I looked at the guy and I said, no. And Lawrence didn't remember that that was his first taste of French attitude. He couldn't believe it. And anyway, to cut a long story short, we ended up sharing a taxi eventually. And 11 months later, I moved to South Africa. So, and I never regretted it. That was 31 years ago.
Yes, and so you fell in love with this larger-than-life man and this larger-than-life life in Africa.
That's right. We moved to South Africa, but first we lived in Durban for 10 years, where Lawrence was in business. Me, I was a fashion designer. I had my own business. I was doing accessories and fashion. And then one day, Lawrence tells me, after 10 years of life in Durban, he says, we're going to move to the bush. We're going to go and live in that game reserve in the middle of Zululand, and we're going to work for a beautiful conservation project for animals, and we're going to work with the local communities for wildlife and nature conservation. And Mia said, okay. And as I already said, I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. But as I said, I was always ready for adventure, so off I went. And as I always say, my first encounter with wildlife, it was a couple of weeks after moving there, and it was a serious cultural adjustment for me to live in the middle of nowhere with electricity shooting off all the time. And then I was cooking rice on the stove, all the air conditioning with holes inside, and a little mouse fell on my stove, followed by a snake, which glopped down that mouse. And that was my first encounter with wildlife. And after that, of course, that was the beginning of the adventure. It didn't stop. And then we got the elephants, or seven elephants, which I had never seen an elephant before in my life. And when I saw those huge, magnificent creatures coming out of that truck, and we put them into an enclosure, electrified enclosures, where they were not supposed to get out. And they did. 24 hours later, they escaped. We got them back after a week. And after that is when my little husband created an amazing relationship with those elephants, because he spent 24 hours a day with them, talking to them, singing to them, giving them food. And he created a beautiful relationship with the matriarch, which was the one very special lady that he fell in love with, but I wasn't jealous. Her name was Nana, is Nana. She's still around. A beautiful old lady full of wisdom and gentleness, and Lawrence and her created an amazing bond. She is the one who knew how to escape which means she was the best one to make friends with so that she would not escape. You know, Lawrence was talking to her, like telling her, don't run away, don't try to break out, because you'll be killed. You know, there was a warning that if they escape again, they're going to be shot.
And so, these were elephants that had to be rehomed because they were angry, distressed elephants that were wreaking havoc, right. And they were going to be culled.
That's right. They were troubled elephants.
Yeah, so. Troubled elephants. And already their matriarch had been slaughtered before their very eyes.
Just before they came down. Because we were supposed to get 9 elephants, and we were told they were troubled elephants. We're not told everything, obviously, with Lawrence. They shot the matriarch and her baby. In front of the rest of the herd because she kept escaping. And anyway, this was dramatic. We were absolutely furious with Lawrence, but there was nothing we could do. So we got the 7 elephants, we got them back, and they adjusted so well that now we've got a herd of 29 elephants.
And amazing. How long do elephants live? Because Nana was in her 40s when she came to you.
Yeah, she's about, she was in her 40s, well. She's about 56, 57, something like that. They live until 60, I think, 60, 65.
Wow.
It depends on their life, not too much stress. It depends if they're in captivity or not. Our elephants are wide, but they live in good condition. We try to give them a stress-free life as much as we can. We protect them, usually with anti-poaching and security. And I think they were very happy. Herd of elephants, they made lots of babies. We had to stop them. We had to give them contraception to the male. We give contraception to the male elephants.
Hey, no, take some responsibility.
The ladies love it when I say that. They always look at their husband. The men get very scared.
And it is reversible.
It's every 6 months. They get an injection from a helicopter, from the veterinarian, every 6 months. So it's reversible. So as soon as we've done the expansion of the game reserve, we'll stop the contraception and they'll start happily making more babies again.
Excellent. Now, so it seems to me like the only time you said no to your husband was that first time in the camp.
Yes.
And everything else, every crazy idea.
Okay.
Fine. We'll do it. We'll find a way.
Yes. Now, he was crazy. You know, he was a crazy man. He had an amazing charisma, but he was a bit of a crazy man. You know, nothing could stop him. He was a free spirit. And he had the most unbelievable ideas and vision of the world. He wanted to save the planet. He was a dreamer, at the same time, but in a good sense. He was a doer as well. I mean, he was making things happen as well. And he was always the first to do. He had crazy ideas, and I loved it. I loved his crazy, his craziness, of course, his bold ideas. So, yes, I followed. And so we created that beautiful, it was a small game reserve, 1,500 hectares, with our 7 elephants, that's all we had. And what I was doing, I was running, we decided to build a lodge. So I was training the staff, doing the marketing, the admin, the financial part, and then he was dealing with the game reserve, the security, the roads. There's a lot of work involved, you know, in a game reserve. So that's the guests, when they come, they're happy, they go into a beautiful game drive and they see the beautiful side of the game. But behind the scene is a hell of a lot of work.
And Lawrence really took over the security and trying to keep the poachers out and all of the, and the upkeep of the game reserve.
And the upkeep of the game reserve, the alien plants. I could hear what he was doing vaguely, you know, the roads. But I was never involved in that very, very much. I was just involved with the other side of the business, which was a perfect combination, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, I mean, during that time, during the Iraq War, he went to save the animals of the Baghdad Zoo. Because, as you say in the book, war rarely has a contingency plan for human victims, and it never has one for animals.
True. Yeah. Yeah, and we were watching CNN that evening, and Lawrence look at the bombing on Baghdad, and then he tells me, what's happening to the animals? There's a magnificent zoo there. Who has been thinking about the animals? So I thought, very good point. It's true. Nobody thought about them. And the following morning, start packing. And off he went to Johannesburg, obtained a visa to go to Kuwait. And from Kuwait, he took a truck to Baghdad. And he was the first non-NGO arriving there. Mm-hmm. And when people, the American army was asking him, what are you coming to do here? I said, I'm coming to save the animals of the zoo. They said he was completely cuckoo.
He was.
But he was. He was mad. But he found the horrors of the war within the zoo. And they saved a few left animals there. And, I mean, you got to be completely crazy to do that. Mm-hmm. And when I asked him, okay, you're going, when are you coming back? He said, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And he stayed there 6 months. And his achievement was absolutely incredible. And his love for animals, his passion for rescuing animals, helping animals, was tremendous. But you know, there's a guy called Howard Buffett. He said, if you help animals, if you help wildlife, you help humans as well. And it's very interesting because he helped humans as well. He helped the zoo to be rebuilt completely, and all, he re-employed those people who were working there, so he recreated the whole. And thanks to the American army, actually, who was extremely supportive of what he was doing.
Because also that helped create a sense of normal life, returning back to normal life.
Exactly.
And that it wasn't a luxury, it was a necessity, you know, to have animals in your life there.
Absolutely.
But that also gave you the first taste of what it was like to run Tula Tula by yourself.
That's right. Yeah, during the 6 months, yes. I really battled in those days, yeah. I was totally unprepared. But above all, I was left with the wrong guy, you know, to run the game reserve. And I really believe that if you want to succeed in anything in life, you have to surround yourself with the right people. And if you do, then you can make it, because otherwise they drag you down. And that's what he did, this guy. Listen, I fired him. But I wasn't surrounded by the best people, so I was not left in the best condition, let's say. It doesn't matter. We survived. And then Lawrence came back, and everything was fine again. That was in 2003.
Yes. Mm. And in that time, you're also getting more animals. People are, they know Lawrence. They know Tula Tula. They know that you have successfully rehomed and kept wild animals. So you're getting more animals in this time. And when did you get your gorgeous rhinos?
Our gorgeous rhino, we got them actually in 2009. Mm-hmm. We got Tabo in October, and we got Tommy in December. Tommy was a Christmas present for Tabo. He has a girlfriend for Christmas. Tabo was 4 months old. He was actually 1 day old when he was found in the bush, in a game reserve in the Free State. And 1 day old baby wandering around, who had never seen a human, never seen a rhino before, because his mother got killed. And he was brought into a rehab center, Mohololo, up in Limpopo. And then we got him. He was 4 months old. He was the most adorable little thing. He was, I can't remember how much did he weigh, I remember. Well, because I brought him all, 70 kilos, yeah. He was a bundle of joy. He was jumping and running after everyone. He owns the lodge. He was brought up, we didn't have the orphanage in those days, so he was brought up next to the lodge, next to the conference center with a carer. And he was just walking around the lodge, a guest. I've got photos of Tabo, a baby rhino like that, next to the guests having their breakfast. I mean, who gets that? I mean, it's just unbelievable. And so he was the most... Now he's grown to a huge, big baby. He's still a big baby. He's a male, you know.
They never young. Grow up.
And but he's still a big baby. He loves a cuddle. He loves to be... He loves the attention. So when guests see him on game drives, he comes to the vehicle and he wants people to pay attention to him. Mm-hmm. And Tombi is different. Tombi was a bit more wild. She was 5 months old when she arrived at Tula Tula. No, when she was 8 months old, because she was 5 months when she was found in the bush on her own, with that, her mother being killed as well. So she was a bit more wilder. So she doesn't really approach the vehicles, doesn't really ask for a cuddle, but Tabo does. Yeah. So what are we waiting desperately now that they make a baby, those two? But Tabo, I don't know.
He's not focused.
He's not focused.
He likes the attention too much. Yes. Yeah. Stay focused.
Or he thinks he's a human. I don't know. Yeah. He thinks she doesn't look like.
Yeah, exactly. You have to paint a picture on her. Might help. Anyway, rhino porn. What does rhino porn look like?
Rhino porn. They just got to watch our hippos. Our hippos are busy making their third baby now. And I call them Romeo and Juliet. So they're a loving couple. And they're doing very well. We've already got two baby hippos. One is Chump. The rangers call him Chump. Because we cannot give we don't know if it's a boy or a girl, you see, because they eat the water all the time. So he puts it's hard to see. To check if it's a boy or a girl. The Chump is the second one, Chocolat.
Aww.
And not chocolate, Chocolat.
So it's in we the give silky them man.
A neutral name which suits them so well. Exactly. And the third one is on its way. So we've got a very busy Romeo and Juliet, so I think that Tabo learn from that.
Talk to each other. Down at the watering hole, have a chat. Get involved.
Because they meet at the water hole.
Girl, yes.
You know, the rhinos and the hippos, they meet at the water hole, so they should have a little chat. Yes. So Romeo should.
Exactly. I was going to put in a word there. But then in 2012, so things are, you're getting. Yeah, on one sense, you're going from strength to strength, but it's Africa, it's a game reserve. Every day is anything could happen, and everything does. And when, you know, things happen to big animals, it happens quickly and catastrophically. And the same applied to Lawrence, that he was away on business. And
yes, yeah. He passed away on the 2nd of March, 2012, and the news came down like it was totally surreal. It was something totally unexpected. He was doing very well. He had a heart attack 6 months before, but he was doing well. He was, and so it was totally unexpected. So it came down like the effect of a bomb, if I can express it like that, like such a shock. And everyone was devastated at Tula Tula. We couldn't believe it. It's difficult to believe that someone passed away if you haven't seen him passing away. And you wonder actually what happened. And anyway, so it was a shock, terrible shock.
It shook the very foundations of you and Tula Tula. It was, the guts were ripped out of everybody and everything. Because also, as you said, he was such a partner. And he had totally dealt with one side while you were dealing with the other.
Yes.
And now you were really thrown in at the deep end.
Exactly. I was thrown into the deep end. Because 2 weeks later, after Lawrence passed away, we were still trying to find our feet. The future looked uncertain. I couldn't have any vision of the future at that stage. I was drowning. I was really lost. And 2 weeks after he passed away, poachers attacked my rhinos and shot at Tabo and got Tabo in the leg. But thanks God, Tabo survived and Tabo was fine. And he didn't damage him too much. It was just very traumatizing, you know, and for everyone, for Tabo, just like us. And that's when I felt that now it was my responsibility to act and to improve security and to improve the safety of the animals and to fight and to do all the work that Lawrence was doing before, to take the decision. It was my responsibility, and it looked enormous viewed in those days. You know, when you're not feeling very good, everything looks impossible. And it looked... the future looked very doom. And anyway, we increased security. Then I created I realized that with no money, you can't protect animals. So I created the Rhino Fund, which helped me, and wonderful guests, and we got donations, and thanks God to that, I could increase the security. And after that, I created the South African Conservation Fund, because after that, I created more and more conservation projects. So slowly but surely, we got out of the doom part, and then...
Because not only were you battling your own personal feelings, your fears for Tula Tula, but also people were questioning you. They were assuming, oh, well, she's just going to run off back to France, as if you hadn't spent, you know, as if you had just been dabbling, you know.
Exactly, yeah. I don't think people realized that I was working as well. And they also that Tula Tula was going to close and that I was going back to France. And that was all assumptions. And we all know the definition of assumptions. And so it was, and it was a tough time because, a lot of people didn't believe that I would be able to carry on, of course. Blonde talking funny, with a funny accent, I suppose. And woman,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
The whole thing.
I think that absolutely
played
a role.
A lot of
role.
People don't believe, and above all, for a lot of people, I was still a foreigner. Mm-hmm. Nobody understood that we created that together with Lawrence. It was like a child. You create a child together, you don't abandon him. That's
yeah.
all. And a child with, I had 70 employees, I had beautiful, I had 21 elephants at that time, I had rhinos, I had a whole...
Family.
Thank
yeah.
you. I didn't want to call it business because it doesn't sound
no.
good. A family. I had it was a family. Two-legged and four-legged. How could I leave that? I wouldn't have been able to live with myself. But anyway, it didn't cross my mind to leave. I'm not saying that I had some moments of discouragement, some serious one. And, you know, the kind of moment when you want to give up, you want to throw yourself by the window. But no, the following day is a new day. And then the new day brings something beautiful. And like a baby elephant in your kitchen. You know, there's sometimes a beautiful a baby elephant which is lost in your garden. And you save that baby. And it's one of the most beautiful rescue story that makes it worth it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then you rescue another baby elephant because his face was stuck in a snare and he couldn't eat from his mother and he would have died of starvation. Then you call the veterinarian and you rely on your amazing team to help. And stories like that, none of the beautiful stories which happen in the bush. Of course, there are some sad moments, but you can't have everything good all the time in life.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have your tough moment as well to appreciate the good moments.
And there's a term you use because some of your very loyal clients who've become friends, who've become patrons, and there was a big donation made, and you tell me about the concept of the word Ubuntu, which meaning
Ubuntu,
that you are here because we are all
here. Of the people, yeah.
Yeah.
Of the people, yes.
That we don't exist in a vacuum, and we need to realize that more.
In a vacuum.
By ourselves.
Oh yeah, by ourselves. No,
alone.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And when I say anyway, whenever I say, I always talk about my team, my wonderful team. You know, most of the people actually have been there for more than 10 years. Some of them have been there from the beginning, 18 years, and I would say the majority 10 years, 15 years. You know. And I love that expression, the saying of Richard Branson, who says, you must train your staff so well that they can leave you, but you must look after them so well that they won't.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautiful. And I think my staff is quite happy. I let them a lot of independence, a lot of responsibility. I call it responsibility. And they've been helping me tremendously. My game ranger... all the people involved within the game reserve, because of course I knew nothing when I started. I had no understanding, no knowledge, conservation. I had a little bit of an idea what Lawrence was doing, but I had so much work on the other side, I didn't have the time really to concentrate, and they helped me. And when I was taking a decision, but I never took it on my own. It was always in consultation with everyone. And sometimes if I was, they were telling me, no, Françoise, don't do this, because that's not going to work. And I always listened, and I think they appreciated that. And the whole team is the same, whether the hospitality team and the game reserve team, we're all one. We're all one, together, working for the same purpose, with the same passion, with the same vision. And this is what makes us so unique at Tula Tula. I think this is what makes Tula Tula so unique, that friendliness and that amazing team spirit, which every guest, when they come, they tell me, we feel that everyone is happy here. And this is a huge compliment for me.
And even, as you say, the elephants, the hippos, the rhinos are happy.
Yes, that's right.
There are some incredible stories in the book of the herd coming at Lawrence's passing and the year anniversary, coming to just be with you, show their respects in the same way that they do with their own dead. And I think Lawrence was one of theirs.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was the most amazing thing. When Lawrence passed away, we found out on the Friday morning, and on the Sunday afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the whole herd of elephants arrived, like in a solemn procession led by Nana. You know, at the beginning, we were quite staggered because they haven't been there for quite a while, and so we just interpreted it, that they came to pay their respect. They were all waiting, standing, looking at my house. And, you know, you don't know what to do in a situation like that. And then, but what is extraordinary, that the following year, exactly the same day, same time, 4th of March, 2013, they all arrived exactly in the same situation. They all stood there, like waiting. Or maybe telling me, we're here, it's okay. Then the following year, exactly the same day, the 4th of March, 2014, exactly the same thing happened. They all arrived, stood there. You see, people believe in whatever they want. People are free to interpret the behavior of animals the way they want. But what I can tell you, that elephants have got an intelligence which is beyond human imagination. So those elephants, they had a purpose when they came. And you know, since then, they come back. They come back and see me. That's Frankie. Frankie is a matriarch. Frankie, my new best friend. I was so scared of her before because we've had some adventures with her, with Lawrence, a temperamental, difficult lady, this one. Very different from Nana. Nana is full of wisdom, peaceful, gentle. Frankie, she's got just her eyes like that. She's just, and she all, I really thought she looks at me funny this way. Maybe she doesn't like me or something. No. She's a beautiful, and then the other day she actually came inside my garden. So Frankie comes and she stays. She stays there and she stares at my house. She stares and she waits. And she's got all her, and she got her boyfriend, her lover, Gobisa, with her. I love stories like that. I don't know if they're going to make babies or two, but you know, they are, it's a beautiful couple. And like in human families, you know, the reconstitué family, reconstitué, how do you say, extended family?
Yeah.
Yes. The reconstituted families.
The Mabula is the son of Frankie. He doesn't like his stepfather. He doesn't like his stepfather to approach his mother too close, so when he does, Gobisa tries to get a little cuddle with Frankie, Mabula arrives and rush in between, boing. But beautiful. So observing those elephants, it's something spectacular because you just create a dialogue in your head. What are they saying to each other? What are they doing? What are they thinking? You know, and it's.
But there are observable things, because like that instance where one of the baby elephants got their face trapped in the snare.
Yes.
You, it was so difficult and couldn't feed and was going to die. These are wild animals. How they normally behave is they would, despite knowing that the baby was in danger, they would have protected it and fought you off. But Nana came forward, and the mother came forward.
That's it.
And pushed the baby forward, knowing...
To my game reserve manager.
Yes, that Woozy, that you would help.
That's it. He said, please, can you help? Look, and he pushed the baby towards her. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. And when Woozy saw that, then he called immediately the veterinarian. We arrived straight away.
He sounds amazing, that Mike Toth guy. He's just the most Indiana Jones.
Yes.
Dun 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 on the chopper with the dart, and he's amazing.
Yeah, and it was a real cowboy operation. That one. Yeah. The helicopter, darting the baby, chasing the animals around. That's a pilot. Unbelievable. That those bush pilots are amazing. And moving all the... But I remember because the herd was running away in all directions. They're going crazy because they don't like helicopters. The baby was lying there. But imagine if you're a mother, an aunt, I mean, the family, the structure of the family of the elephant, they all... It's all their baby. And then the chopper had to... the veterinarian jumped out of the helicopter and with Woozy there while they were watching that the elephants don't come back because you don't want there to be... them pushing the helicopter away and pushing the humans away. So it was a real cowboy operation. And that evening, I remember, it was wonderful when we heard that the baby was reunited with all the family elephants. They were all happy, trumpeting, touching him, that everything was fine, and he could feed from the mother. Then it was an amazing. So I invited everyone at the lodge that evening. All come for a drink at the lodge at 7 o'clock. Guess who was at the entrance of the lodge wanting to come to celebrate as well? The whole herd of elephants. Is that amazing? No, because normally an operation like that should be very traumatizing. Mm. Helicopter being chased away, the babies. It was amazing. They were all there in the middle of the road waiting to get in.
Waiting for a glass of champagne.
Yeah. See, we want to celebrate. We want to come and say thank you. Yeah. Want to celebrate as well. Is that beautiful? So here's where I make them talk, but I don't know what they're saying. But it doesn't matter. It's very unusual behavior. Normally, they should have gone into the bush, hidden, and recovered from their traumatic day. That's what normal elephants would do, but not ours. They come for a drink at the lodge. Gate crash.
Exactly. But as you say, it is a daily struggle. I mean, these are the amazing moments and just the very idea that these animals will be extinct if you don't do what you're doing and if we don't help support you doing what you're doing. Because poachers are a relentless force. And at the moment, they're mostly coming for your rhinos.
Yes.
But
yes,
they're
yes.
coming for your vultures, your elephants, your hippos, for their teeth.
Yes, they're coming for game as well, for all of our antelopes, for meat as well.
Right.
They come in, but it doesn't matter. They're destructive. They're destructive. And actually, Sunday, as you say, it's relentless. I mean, Sunday, I'm in London, and I wake up with photos on my iPhone of all the photos of... dead animals and poachers. From 2 o'clock in the morning, my anti-poaching team has been fighting, there's been shooting, so on. So they arrested 6 guys, shot 1 dead, 2 are in hospital, the rest are in jail. And that's a serious case, you know. Those guys have been coming from a long way. They actually shot at the elephants. I don't think they wanted to shoot the elephants. They just shot at the elephants. They must have been on their way to keep them
away.
Out.
Yeah.
And that is, for me, that is the biggest... I sent a statement saying that I regret the death of the poacher. And everybody is putting on social media, why are you regretting the death of a poacher? You shouldn't... As I understand, but you know what? It doesn't matter. You always regret the death of somebody. But the thing, they don't regret the death of... animals, our animals have been suffering too much. we're losing animals, and the poaching of rhinos as well is a serious threat. So if you let one happen, the other one will happen. But we've just been re-dehorning Tabo and Tombi anyway 2 weeks ago because...
Let's talk about that a little bit, because at first you tried, you didn't want to dehorn them. And right. The horns are just like our nails.
That's right.
And they do have a purpose for them, but it's not necessary for their survival. But it's just made out of keratin, just like our hair and nails. But it is considered in a lot of Eastern countries it cures cancer. It's
like a Viagra for men,
yes,
as well.
Exactly.
You call that,
it's an aphrodisiac.
For virility, aphrodisiac, yeah.
For virility. Yeah. So it is highly prized. It is more valuable than gold or platinum. And so people then, like diamonds, like gold, then want to steal it and sell it for monetary gain. And so one of the solutions was to put a dye and sort of a poison in there, so that when people ate one, you'd be able to see it in an airport, in infrared lights, and two, if people ate it, they would get sick.
That's it.
But then that stopped working for various reasons.
For very sad reason, for the media destroyed it. Destroyed the idea why. It's called politics, it's a bit complicated, it's a bit long to explain, but unfortunately the media destroyed this idea. I thought if we all unite, all poison the horn, and all start sending press release that some people have died from consuming rhino horn, that would wake up maybe people in the Far East, and imagine you start advertising in all the supermarkets the chocolate could you buy is poison, nobody will buy chocolate. So we just hoped that something like that would happen. Unfortunately the media... That's why I think it's not working. I say, yeah, well, it's still experimental. But if, we launch a big PR campaign, we'll have done. So after that, 1 year later, 2 years later, I decide to dehorn the rhinos because that was the one and only solution. The poaching was just going crazy, more than 1,000 every year. And for the best protection possible, we did that. We dehorn them, and we do that every year. So that's the third year that we did it. The first time was 3 years ago. We just re-dehorn them because it grows just like nail, just like hair, and to protect them. That's it. It's a very emotional operation because we have to dart the rhinos and we have to cut them. It's horrible. It's not nice to watch, but it's for their own good. Better to have a dehorned rhino than a dead rhino.
Absolutely. And... Now, one of Lawrence's dreams that you have made happen is an orphanage for baby hippos and rhinos and elephants whose mothers, unfortunately, have been poached or killed or died or whatever has happened to them.
Yeah, or sick animals. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, we opened it in 2000 and. 14, 15. It was financed thanks to an organization, an international animal welfare organization called Four Paws, who are doing an amazing work worldwide. We did that in partnership with them and partnership with the local communities. Unfortunately, a tragedy struck, the poaching tragedy. Mm-hmm. Stroke. We had two baby rhinos which got killed inside the orphanage. Then we had to go shut the orphanage. And then we reopened a couple of months later, talking about all wildlife. So I think a lot of places like that now open, and we don't say what kind of animal. We talk about the animals which are not endangered, and a lot of rehabilitation centers, like they don't. We're calling it the Rescue and Rehabilitation Center. We got all sort of animals. But
it's for impalas and antelopes.
That's
just
it. Exactly. Nothing endangered, just not to attract attention.
Yeah. It's absolutely unfortunate. I have to say, and I hope you finally feel that, Lawrence would not be surprised how you've stepped up but he'd be incredibly proud.
I think, yeah, he would be surprised too. I think he'd be very surprised. It's been a learning curve for me, and I think Lawrence would be... I'm still learning. I don't know everything, of course. And you never know everything, but Lawrence would be... he must be staggered, but very proud. Yeah, I'm sure.
Very proud.
Absolutely.
And as well of this book. Now, Katya, I'm going to bring you in because I want to know sort of how this book came about, because I know Lawrence had written The Elephant Whisperer. And while this isn't a follow-up, I think it is sort of a companion piece in a way. Mm. So how did you two start working together to tell this incredible story?
Well, Françoise, I think you for a long time wanted to continue the story, because after Lawrence passed away, there were questions from all over the world, friends, but a lot of people who'd been to Tula Tula, wanting to know what had happened to Tula Tula, what had happened to the herd, what had happened to Françoise. So she wanted to put her story out. And Kim is somebody who was working with Françoise, very...
Photographer.
And she's also somebody who I knew. And she contacted me 3 years ago, 2 years ago now, and said... contacted me via my brother.
Two years ago.
Would your sister be interested in writing the sequel to The Elephant Whisperer? And I'd loved The Elephant Whisperer, and I love elephants. But I didn't take it that seriously. but I happened to be in South Africa at the time. I live in France, and I happened to be in South Africa at the time. Made contact with Françoise and said, I am interested. And Françoise, being the impulsive woman that she is, said, come up.
Let's
come
do
and
it.
Spend the night. So we had one night free, and my husband and I went up and met Françoise, and we just connected. We just thought, yes, we could do this. But at that stage, I was busy with another book, and I said to Françoise, I just need to finish my book, and then let's talk again. Fast forward a couple of months to August that year, and Françoise was coming to France to see her family and to spend some time there, and she invited me up for a couple of days. And I thought to myself, let me write one chapter. Let me see, because I'd never written somebody else's story before. Let me see if I like it. Let me see if Françoise likes it. Let me see if we like working together. What if she hates my writing?
Yes, because you're sort of channeling her story her voice, which is one difficult to do. It's sort of like interpreting or translating. Mm. You know, it's sort of difficult to get into somebody else's head and somebody else's story in a way that they would like. Mm. What happened with that chapter?
Well, first of all, what happened was Françoise just said, open doors. You can speak to anyone, speak to me, ask me anything. Nothing was taboo. But of course, we didn't really know each other, so it was I was quite cautious in the beginning with the questions that I asked. But I think a lot of that information from the first chapter came also from speaking to the people at Tula Tula. And then I wrote it and I sent it, and now you have to tell how you felt when you read it.
Then it was the most emotional chapter. You talk about the first chapter. Very emotional, beautifully written, beautifully put together. It was a piece of art. I thought it was, and then I don't know if I'm going to talk about. I was in contact with Ingrid from Penn Macmillan because we were republishing The Elephant Whisperer, and I told her, you know, with Katya, we just intend to write a book, the sequel of The Elephant Whisperer. I want to call it An Elephant in My Kitchen, because I had one. And would you be interested? She said, send. You never know. She said it 2 days later.
It was 2 days before Christmas that we sent it to her.
Yeah.
And she said,
I know,
I will get back to you sometime at the end of January, because she had a lot on her plate. First week of January, she got back to us. She loves it.
We're taking it. Yeah.
And we're taking it.
Do you know, I mean, I have the whole story just from the first chapter.
One chapter. Mm.
So that was. That we were.
That was January last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how much time have you spent at Tula Tula? Lucky woman.
I've been three times. Two or three times, yeah. Mm-hmm. And hours and hours and hours of WhatsApp messages and calls. I would send Françoise questions, and she would just stream through her thoughts relating to my questions. And that was very, very helpful, because I always got everything straight from inside her head and her heart. And then I was able to filter it into
beautiful words. In amazing words. Because I was telling her, because when I was sending her recordings, it was just this happened and this happened, and I remember that happened. So it was all in all. But she had that ability, Katia, to put everything back into perspective, took, and then put it in beautiful words.
Yeah.
that's talent.
Yes. And it's a lovely read. It is a lovely read.
Thank you.
And as you say, very emotional. Very emotional.
Yeah.
And
Did you cry a lot?
A lot.
Now some nice part. Now some funny part.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, crying with awe and joy and wonder, as well as, you know, deep sadness. Mm. But that's something I want to get to the heart of now, is because you absolutely need our help. All the money that you raise goes right back to these animals and conservation and education and medicine and enclosures and everything.
Yeah.
And yet, I know, I mean, I was looking at one of the YouTube videos of the herd of elephants, and it's had, you know, I don't know how many hits. And everyone's, you know, everyone's crying when they see this. I mean, it's just amazing. Mm. And then you like it on Facebook, and I'm done. How do we get people?
How do you help?
Exactly. How do we help? And how do we get beyond liking a video on Facebook to help? And tell us the plans for Tula Tula now, and how we can get involved, and what we can actually do.
So at the moment, we've just opened something which is very close to my heart, because it's about education. I mean, education is key to conservation, and more people need to be aware what needs to be done in conservation. And we just opened the Tula Tula Volunteers Academy. So that as well, you find it on our website, on social media, Instagram and Facebook, the Tula Tula Volunteers Academy. We get people from all around the world to come and learn about running a game reserve, about animals. So we make people work, and they pay a certain amount of money, but to stay in very nice condition, in tents with a beautiful view. And you work, I've got two leaders, two game rangers, who've been with us for 10 years, Promise and Victor. And you learn so much about conservation that, I mean, so far, the enthusiasm of these people is just phenomenal. And then what we do is that one of them will be from the local community, a young Zulu man or woman who will come and learn about conservation and learn about anti-poaching, so that he goes back to his school or goes back to his village, and he can talk about it, and he can see what is being done for future generation to keep our wildlife protected, so that in 20 years time there are still animals for their children and their grandchildren and so on. So the wonderful thing is part of the South African Conservation Fund, which is our non-profit organization, and all the funds we get from the volunteers camp, this is what I found, to be able to raise funds actually to help us with all our conservation projects. We've got more conservation. One of the biggest ones is, of course, our anti-poaching is very, very extremely expensive to keep up every month. But as well with the expansion of Tula Tula, we're expanding about an extra 4,000 hectares. That means another many more kilometers of electric fencing. And so we've set up a system of adopting our elephants. So adopting one vet of something like $50 per month. And you choose your elephant. We've got an elephant family tree. So you choose if you want a baby, if you want a big one, if you want Frankie, if you want Mabula or Gobiza. So people have got, you know, people come to Tlatula, they say that it's like a spiritual experience, meeting our elephants, the emotional impact that herd has got on humans. It's phenomenal. And they all got their favorite elephant. That they say, when they leave, they say, okay, I'm adopting this one for 3 months. And so this is how we get donations, and we send them photos of the elephant. So we tried, on the other hand, we got the hospitality side. We got two beautiful lodges, and that as well, all the money goes back into conservation. We don't make money in conservation. This is not the purpose. We work because we have a big job to achieve. We've got a goal, we've got a purpose, and we've got a passion.
Thank you so much, Françoise, Katia. Absolutely inspirational.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
For more fascinating, extraordinary women, go to Radio Gorgeous at www.radiogorgeous.com.